And she said, you know what, the world does not need, in her view at the time, this was some time ago, 30 years ago, she's like, we don't need any more saddlers. The world like is desperate for quality saddle fitters. And she says, my advice to you, just spend all your time learning the fitting. And it was a good starting point, and it was good advice. I don't regret that.
Interesting.
At all, because I think every saddler should learn those skills, and vice versa. I think every fitter should spend a little more time at the bench doing, you know, saddlery work.
There is a depth and a breadth to our lives that largely goes unexplored. As an equestrian life mindset coach and host of this podcast, I am here to lead you on that exploration. Deep conversations covering topics in and out of the show ring with industry leaders and unsung heroes alike, sharing their stories and what makes their journey unique, but relatable at the same time. We all have stories to share and lessons to trade, something we've learned from a horse or from each other. So relax and be ready to listen with more than just your ears. I'm Tracy Mitchell. Welcome to Hitting Your Stride. What image comes to your mind when I say the phrase paid observer? Chances are pretty good that a saddle fitter doesn't readily find its way to the top of that list. But if you ask Christian Lowe, it's exactly how he sees himself. Christian has been paying attention to the finer points of saddle fitting for nearly 30 years, a profession he threw himself into after starting out in the wholesale and retail side of the equine industry. It was actually the decision to seek out an education in the heart of English riding country and the napping of a strange dog on his lap that kick-started his journey in earnest. We talk about a lot of things from his unique perspective. The differences between industry norms in England, mainland Europe, and at home in Canada, how he found his niche while also finding his confidence, and how the idea of balance can mean different things to different parties in the horse world. And as we wrap up this enthralling and informative episode, Christian lands on a touchstone topic for me: mentorship and its importance to life. He's not afraid to admit that everyone can use a little extra input to help us focus on reaching our goals and needs as they change throughout life, both personally and professionally. So, as you listen, put yourself in the role of this podcast's latest guest and channel your own paid observer to see what you can learn along the way. So without further ado, Christian Lowe, welcome to Hitting Your Stride. Okay, well, welcome Christian Lowe to Hitting Your Stride. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Yeah, it's been a while since we've talked. I don't know, 20 years?
Yeah, I think it has been. Yeah.
Awesome. All right. So, Christian, what was your this is for me moment when you got into horses and knew this is what you wanted to do with your professional life?
So I didn't know the answer to that question until after the fact. I was searching for, you know, something that was going to satisfy all aspects of my life. So had to involve horses, had to, I was desperate to have a trade, you know, something to do with my hands, a skill. And I was, you know, with horses, you tend to gravitate towards a farrier. And, you know, back in, say, 1990s, there wasn't a lot of, you know, your local vet was also kind of the person that dabbled in the chiro, dabbled in the dentistry. It was all kind of under one umbrella. Like, I had no idea, like, oh, I'll become a equine dentist, or I'll become a, you know, not that I could have pulled any of that off, but it, I was just struggling to find what would meet all that criteria. And then really just jotting all these ideas down, like, oh, what, you know, and again, growing up in kind of Southern Ontario, there there's not a, you don't have a ton of exposure to saddlers, so it's not like you're seeing someone work in the trade and go, oh, that looks interesting. I would love to try that. So yeah, I just stumbled. It was on my list of things that I needed to research. And the more I got into it, and then kind of when I started doing it, going, oh yeah, this meets all these criteria that I had.
So you were into riding, you were doing eventing in your 20s. Like, what was it, were you riding in completely uncomfortable, dysfunctional saddles that made you think? And like, are you a creative type naturally that, like you said, you want to do things and build things with your hands? What was the connection there for you?
Yeah, so I had no idea, about saddles, saddle fitting. I wasn't aware growing up whether a saddle fit or didn't. There's a few horses or scenarios that I would love to go back in time and revisit and think, oh, that wasn't a problem horse. That was a problem human.
Exactly.
So I would, but I just didn't, I didn't have any idea. And also didn't have any idea that, struggling with a lot of ADHD issues, you working with your hands is the best thing that you can do. It's using a certain parts of your brain that just cause you to focus and really be productive and have a satisfying work. I hadn't, it was all by accident. I had no idea. So yeah, as I say, I think kind of the environment, the first stable and kind of the main stable that I only ever worked at as a kid, the owner of that barn had, and I didn't know this until we were having a conversation when he was well and truly retired and really had, we were kind of, he was kind of saying, oh, it's funny that you ended up in that, because I actually was a saddler that chose not to do any saddle work, and he made his living as a coach and trainer and rider. And I had no idea that he was a saddler and that I was working with someone who could have easily apprenticed me
Oh my
and
goodness.
got me started when I was just, in my early teens. And I had no idea. So but I think all the tack fit well on that farm because of that background. So
There
you
you
weren't
are.
truly aware, oh, somewhere else things don't work this well, or tack isn't in this good of condition, or, so again, I didn't know what I didn't know, or didn't, I had no clue what I had access to.
Well, and
So
obviously there was a different path you were meant to take if that information was not to your privy. So there you go.
yeah, so it's funny, like there was no light bulb moments for me, or and I do know of some fitters that for sure they had these moments in their life where they're, I had so many poorly fitting saddles that I just had to get into it myself to rectify it. That wasn't me. Then, kind of fun fact, we grew up with very little. My sister and I were the riders in the family. My sister owned a saddle, but I never owned my own tack. I borrowed anything I wasn't nailed down, and was often riding, the proverbial free horse, free to a good home, and came with some tack, or we're borrowing whatever, mainly from my poor sister who financed most of it. But yeah, so it was literally had no exposure to it.
Okay. So what did you learn about yourself working in wholesale and retail saddlery that guided you into fitting?
Yeah, great question. And again, it's hindsight. While I was working in the wholesale side of it in particular, it's almost nothing to do with horses.
Hmm.
My role on the wholesale side of it was either in the warehouse packing a box, for an order to go out. So yeah, you're packing horse equipment, but you're not anywhere near a horse. You're not talking about horses, nothing. And when you're doing sales calls and talking to a tack shop owner, very much the conversations are, what colors are on trend this year? What should I be stocking? Is this certain product selling well? Is this back in stock? The most boring conversations you can have. And you could be working selling, potato chips, or it almost had nothing to do with horses except for the fact that the product happened to be going to the horse industry. And what was really frustrating for me was, that was very fresh, me coming from riding every day to kind of saying, that's it. I'm clearly not going to be cut out as a rider, but I miss the horses dearly. So it wasn't until working in just a regular job where you're the sights, the sounds, the smells, the everything to do with horses is gone, that you really, like, I just was like, okay, how do I blend? So for sure, what I learned about myself was that, horses had to be in my life in some way.
I love that. And I'm 99% sure, like, the listeners can all completely relate, I'm sure, because I know, like, there's been a recent possible little jig-jag in my path that I could have gone for. And I'm like, even though it would have to do with horses, I'm not sure it would get me into the, no pun intended, arena that I need to be in. And that's with them. So I can completely relate.
Yeah, and it's, I deal with customers all the time that I sometimes envy, because they are in a job where they can afford to do the hobby. But the problem is working all week and trying to fit in family and all your other maybe work obligations and as a spouse and all those things, trying to fit horses in. So you have the income to afford it. And I kind of had to make a choice, when you take a path of no post-secondary education, which was not a route for me. I'm in an industry that certainly in the beginning doesn't really afford you to have a horse. So it's that blend, like, how do you, when someone's gone the route of, hey, I made great money, and the only struggle I have is trying to figure out how to spend more time with my horse versus I get to just play with other people's horses all day.
Well, I think we're similar in the sense, like, I've ridden once since 1997. Like, that's, and a lot of people go, what? How do you do that? But I'm like, I get to spend, like, this time with other people's horses in ways that no one else gets to do. And I swear, like, the each hour I spend with them, connections are made that totally satisfies me and my love to be with them. So yeah, it's amazing.
But also too, and people may not believe this. Maybe they think I'll say this just to justify the course of my life. But you may agree or disagree. Since you stopped riding, and you essentially had to be your, I call myself a paid observer. So I've learned more about horses and riding since I stopped riding than when I was like riding all the time and trying to be the best possible version of Christian Lowe, the rider. And I wasn't getting anywhere. And now that I think about it, I'm like, yeah, you never once, you were so self-absorbed. You never once, say, went to a show and just watched people warm up. And now I do that for fun, and I watch people warm up and go, oh, that's interesting, or oh, wow, that is interesting. Like, why is that happening? And you
Yeah,
think,
exactly.
and I and I
I've never thought of that point that you've just, I've never thought of that before, but it's so true. And I love to learn. I'm a constant, ask questions. I mean, hence the podcast. But yeah, I totally agree. What did you call it? A paid observer. Interesting.
Yeah. Well, it's because you're invited to someone's farm. They're paying you a consult fee to come and especially in the early days of saddle fitting, when you're, to be honest, you're not confident at all in your skills or your abilities. So you're really out there going, yeah, that doesn't look right. And then the more you watch, and then your volume of observing goes from a few people a week to a few people a day as you get a reputation. And then exponentially your observation skills kind of get honed in, and you're like, okay, what specifically are we trying to accomplish here? What's the question? How do we answer that question? Because when in the beginning, it's like a fire hose. You're just being thrown everything at you, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm loving this. This is great. All right. Was it a scary move to make when you jumped into saddle fitting with both feet like you did? Did you have to convince yourself it was the right thing, or was there something instinctual that let you know you were on the right path? And I'm specifically talking about that trip to England.
Yeah, so I for sure was not worried or scared or, oh my God, what have I done? Because I had nothing. I was literally, I wasn't sacrificing anything. I hadn't given up. I had already sacrificed everything on my journey to try and become a rider. And literally, I'm looking at an empty cup, going, okay, well, how do I can scrape together a plane ticket. I didn't, it just appealed to my sense of adventure. I was literally just too naive to, the girlfriend I had at the time, who is now my wife, was busy with her school career and was kind of like, okay, you're going to England? Are we still a couple or an item or what's going on? And I'm like, I will be back. This hang tight. I don't know how long I'm, and literally I because it was cheaper, I bought a one-way ticket.
Oh, wow.
She says, okay, so you're telling me you're coming back, but the evidence suggests otherwise. And I have dual citizenship, so I did have a British passport. My parents are English, although I was born in Canada. But it was just a fantastic adventure to me, and I knew that a romantic view of England is that it's just the home of equestrianism, right? Like that, there's so many cool things like. You can't pick up a horse and hound as a kid in Canada and go, there's like shows 6 days a week. You can see the show schedule in the back of the horse and hound going, and the wanted ads for grooms,
Yeah.
and all that. It was just a thriving equestrian industry, and I was like, oh, I have to get over there. I have to figure it out.
So once you got over there and your mentor that you learn with, your master saddler friend, David Nangreve, well, you were there from 97 to 2001. So I guess your girlfriend, she was patient.
No, that was in Canada.
Oh,
So
you
I did the
were in
apprenticeship in
Canada.
Canada. So
Oh, okay.
I left the kind of wholesale job and, said to my boss at the time, like, I want to transition into a sat like saddler, saddle fitting. I wasn't sure. And when I think I was more on the saddler path, like, repairing saddles, that tack, that kind of thing. And when I got to England, what I did was, I just, the salesman in me, I was just cold calling. I was just going, literally taking a train or a bus or and kind of a country kid from Ontario navigating public transit was absolutely hilarious to watch. I'm sure I could have made a, a movie about that. But the I just luckily stumbled across a tack store that the woman who owned it was this eccentric in an awesome way. Like she just, one of those people said, well, I knocked on the door or went into the tack store, said, is the owner around? And everyone like kind of recoils, like, who's asking? We're, but the Canadian accent had curiosity piqued, and they're like, well, we'll see if she's available. So she kind of came out of the house that was on the property and said, well, you better come in for a cup of tea and explain to me what it is you're trying to accomplish. And yeah, it was funny that we're sitting down having a cup of tea, and her little dog gets on my lap, curls up, and falls asleep. And it was the next day she said to me, I trust my dog more than any person. So that's how it all started, was she just was like, if my dog trusts you, I do. So at the end of this, tea turned into lunch and then another couple of cups of tea. And then she just said, I don't know where you're staying, but what you're going to do, it wasn't an option. She says, what you're going to do is go collect your things and you're going to be staying here for the rest of your time. And I said, well, I don't know how much longer I'm staying. Like, I don't have that much in the way of funds. And she's like, you'll just stay here. We will feed you. Don't worry about it. And yeah, I stayed a month, and that was as much, to be honest, was getting a bit homesick. Like I felt like, oh, I could easily just stay here and work here. I love it. I mean, and there's no legal reason why I couldn't have. But at the same time, obviously my girlfriend, who is now my wife, was not here with me. And yeah, I just, if it wasn't for that kind of friendliness and openness, and they had, a few saddle fitters on staff, and she said, you know what, the world does not need, in her view at the time, this was some time ago, 30 years ago, she's like, we don't need any more saddlers. The world like is desperate for quality saddle fitters. And she says, my advice to you, just spend all your time learning the fitting. And it was a good starting point, and it was good advice. I don't regret that
Interesting.
at all, because I think every saddler should learn those skills, and vice versa. I think every fitter should spend a little more time at the bench, doing, saddlery work. It might stop them asking the impossible every 30 minutes
Interesting.
when they realize what it takes to actually pull off what they're asking sometimes.
Wow.
But yeah, so just but when I returned to Canada, it wasn't straight away that I hooked up with Dave Nangrave, but I quickly realized that I wasn't going to be the best fitter I could be without apprenticing with someone who really knew what they were doing. So
Right. What an
yeah,
interesting chapter.
that's yeah, so and it's been a while since I've been out in England at the business end of things. So I've been back and forth to England many, many, many times, but not in the last 5 years for sure. But the one thing that, English people buying an English made product, they're not paying the same price as we are at or weren't. I think prices have increased slowly, but the whole industry worked on volume. So the tack store that where I got my first introduction to it, they were sometimes selling 4 saddles a day, 5-6 days a week.
Wow.
So the volume of saddles that they moved was mind-boggling. And that was, you know, pretty cool to see. But when you see in Canada, just, okay, it's a massive country, you're never going to sell 4 saddles a day, like, period. So it was very much like what was a good month for you might have been just an average day for my friends in England. And you know, that was the biggest difference, but also the amount we had to charge for things. Like, you're traveling a much greater distance, you're importing everything, and you're, you know, paying Canadian dollars for, you know, at one point, you know, the English pound was $2.25 at one point many, many, many years ago. So you were, you know, everything was just crazy pricing. And there wasn't a lot of distributors or middlemen importing product in that you had access to now. So the view of just how things have changed is just the volume. And, you know, when I first started, there wasn't a lot of really highly skilled saddlers around. You know, saddles were still kind of being sold through tack stores, where you would kind of sign 3 out with the help of your coach. You'd choose one and take 2 back and pay for the one you didn't bring back. And, you know, now, you know, it's a little crazy, because now there's the French brands are well represented, and it's a very, very slick industry. You know, they're well financed, they're doing things, believe it or not, on a really professional level. You know, where you have sales reps out there really well armed with good information, lots of product, lots of options. You know, they're able to really address a lot of scenarios easily. So, you know, things are different, but my view, you know, I think the industry has grown up a lot. And there are more people calling themselves saddle fitters now, which there isn't the same. I think things are on an even keel. Before, it was underserviced. Now it's well serviced, but I think we have a lot of undereducated people, where the fitters, it's unregulated, right? I benefited from that. I was able to just come back from England and say, well, I just got back from England and now I'm a saddle fitter. And I really didn't have any right to be calling myself that. But the difference was, I set to work trying to figure out how to increase my skill base as quickly as possible. But I was earning while I was learning. You know, and a lot of fitters are trying to do that too now. But it's a shame, because a lot of the benefits of taking the slow route that are very sparse. Whereas if you can just get your volume of saddles up, you're surviving. Okay, fine. Some people are going to complain that their saddle doesn't fit right or never did. But, you know, when you're basing it on a volume thing, you're like, okay, fine, then don't use me. Right. You know, and that's, I think, where the industry is going. I'm getting off track a little bit, but, you know, I think all of this choice and being able to call, you know, multiple brands, not just one French company, but you can, you know, you can see it all, the best of the best being brought right to your stable, by a rep that's, you know, I know there's a lot of turnover in the industry, but the training from some of the companies is pretty good. I mean, they're trained just on their own product, but they know that product well.
Right.
And, you know, it's pretty cool now versus, say, only having the choice between a Crosby, a Steumann, and a Passier. Right?
Exactly.
I mean, that's where it was in 70s, 80s, 90s, early 90s. Anyway, there was just so few options.
Well, I really appreciate what you mentioned about, you know, how much the education is in there and, you know, how you saw yourself coming over from England and quote unquote having no right to do. But like you said, it is a learning curve. We touched on this at the very beginning about, you know, paid to observe. So you gather that information as you go. Yes. And I will get to this topic a little bit more in a further question, because I think it's something that everybody kind of wonders about the world of saddle fitting. But to the next question, what do you learn about yourself and what you're capable of in this, the fitting industry?
Yeah, that's great. Like there's a lot of hangover for me of, you know, when you essentially aren't built for traditional schooling, you leave school pretty demoralized. And you think, okay, what are my options in life, and how do I make a living in an industry I'm passionate about? I don't think anyone listening to this would argue with the fact that it is really hard to find a decent employer in the horse industry that, you know, is going to pay you a living wage, that isn't trying to bamboozle you with free board or, you know, just an honest, well-paying job with benefits and regular work hours and, you know, a decent amount of, you know, paid off time. If there's any grooms listening right now that are basically, you know, when's the last time you went to the dentist? When's the last time you were actually able to, you know, have a vacation, you know, a proper vacation that you, you know, and it's just really hard. So learning about myself was just the finding something that all of a sudden was making sense for me and didn't leave me feeling like I was an idiot, you know, like I'm pretty hard on myself, but the reality is like I hadn't up to that point found something that I was passionate about, driven to do, but also understood. Like there's lots of things that I enjoy, but I clearly, you know, I love working on cars, but no one would pay me to do that. It's absolutely, you know, there's loads of things that I'm just like, I don't understand that concept at all. You know, whereas saddles are, you know, things just make sense for me. And I think it's just because you understand what they're being used for so well. So the leap from this inanimate object having to work with and moving living creature, and then you're going to introduce a rider as well, and it's just second nature for me. So I think, you know, learning about myself was just like, yeah, you found a niche, you know, and that you're maybe just a little more clever than you thought, or you know, that was nice. I needed that in my life, to be honest.
That's amazing. And I feel I kind of had, again, something similar when I got into the program to learn how to massage. It was very science-based and that was not my strength. So I was intimidated. I had to work extra hard and I too was hard on myself. And I found that when I could put, like you said, life to it and understand the workings, how it involved with the horse, etc. Then it became as like I realized it was second nature for me as well. So yeah, I can completely relate when you're tested in a way that you're not sure what the outcome will be, but you feel like it's something that you could really connect with, and you take that chance.
Yeah, and it's nice, and it can be quite difficult to find, that factor in what you're doing. I mean, I meet people every day. You hear people like, "Oh, is it Friday yet? Oh, I can't believe it's going to be Monday already." Whereas I never have that anymore. Haven't never even uttered those words in my whole saddle fitting career. I mean, there's certain times where you're like, okay, I've been out on the road long enough, I need to get home, but not wishing, that it's like it's draining, taxing me. And when you find your thing, and it's pretty cool.
Awesome. All right, Christian. So, what is your general philosophy when it comes to saddling? Saddle fitting, sorry.
Yeah, I'm so glad this question's in here. I have it's the KISS philosophy. Keep it simple, saddler, right? Or keep it simple, saddle fitter. Keep it simple, stupid. It is amazing to me online now. So if you say to someone who's like thinking, I'm thinking about getting into saddle fitting, and you're like, okay, that's great, and they're consuming all this data that's online now, YouTube experts of saddle fitting, and I've never heard so much ridiculousness. It just boggles my mind how complicated a saddle fitter wants it to be. And I think because I can't chew gum and walk at the same time, I'm forced to just do very, very simple things well. And saddle fitting is just that. The philosophy is basically the saddle needs to be horse-shaped. That's the philosophy. And then the rider portion is it has to put the rider in balance. And the problem with that term balance in equestrian and saddle world, it has multiple definitions when we say a horse is balanced versus the rider being in balance versus the saddle balanced. When we balance the saddle, it's level, basically. But that we've gone from that. So I just always address the basics. Do the bare minimum to a saddle if I believe it's a good fit to begin with. If that saddle belongs on that horse, then your saddle fitting is very, very easy. If you're struggling with a saddle fit, like you're, being called back multiple times, chances are there's a soundness issue, or that saddle does not belong on that horse. And so as I gotten further and further into the career, it was like when the penny dropped that, yeah, don't complicate it. It really is simple.
I
And
would, sorry, I would
you can
completely agree.
package it.
Sorry.
Yeah, thanks. It's tough because what I see on my days where I'm feeling less confident and where I think, okay, am I has the have things gone and turned on me, as in, you're being left behind, granddad, here, like things are advancing, and technology and you know, our understanding of equine anatomy and that. And I think, yeah, there's so many clever people out there who, you know, are spending so much time drawing on horses with chalk and using Latin names for everything. And, you know, it's all marketing it to an extent. You know, it's great that their foundation of knowledge is that great. But then when I watch their, you know, kind of before and after video, and I'm thinking, okay, you just outed yourself. That's so, you know, that saddle didn't fit before. It doesn't fit now. What are you doing? But you did a beautiful presentation with all of the drawings and the measuring and the big words and everything else. And it's that makes me think, wow, I wish that was a skill of mine. But then when I really look at it and I think, no, it's not me anyway.
I love the fact that you said that that's not you. Because it's you're authentic. You are who you are. And this is what you're doing. I love the fact that you said to keep it simple, because my response to this world of saddle fitting as an equine massage therapist is that things are extremely complicated, and I don't think that they need to be. It's funny, you know, you said, you know, I don't think this is, I can't remember how you referred to yourself, but you've been around for a while. And I could say the same thing about me, which, you know, when something shiny and new comes in and people are like, ooh, like, is there something better out there? It's like, yeah, sure, check and see what else is out there. But I think there is something to be said to the tried and true, or something to be said about the tried and true, and the knowledge and the experience and your gut instinct when it comes to the simplicity of how it should be. I'm kind of living by a mantra right now that's like, let it be easy, because I truly don't think it needs to be as complicated as it has been. And you've described it perfectly.
Yeah, thanks. It to me, when I, it's definitely newer people in the industry that I see wanting it to be a little more exotic, and I'm assuming that's like, hey, I need to stand out, and it like, why am I going to call you? Why would I get you to fit my saddle? And maybe the answer would be like, well, I'm, you know, I have all this technical information, and I kind of think about it as the, okay, you know, even my short time in Pony Club, there was a classic example where there were some kids that would, you know, ride beautifully and fail all the written stuff because they, like me, can read a manual and not retain the information. They actually have to like do it. And then there's the ones that, you know, I've had fitters shadow me, you know, you share a few saddle fitting books and they can repeat word for word what was written in that book. And they sound like they've been doing it for a decade. Mm-hmm. And then you see them actually around a horse or put a thread and needle in their hand and you realize, okay, so what you're able to do is retain information and regurgitate it really well, which is why you were a straight A student. But you cannot do that with the physical experience. And I think when I watch massage therapists work, it's a very similar thing, is that your hands are, you have to touch and palpate many, many, many horses before you know that most of the time 2 and 2 is 4, but it's just that little spidey sense that tingles when you're going, no, actually this is the exception to the rule scenario. And it's only experience that will teach you that. It's only time and mistakes and, you know, that being wrong and sticking around long enough to show, to see, hey, I had that wrong. Or like And I've had it like in my first 5 years, the strongly held beliefs over certain salary things or how things should fit. You know, luckily I had clients who were still with me going, do you remember how I, you know, to get geeky for a second, but it's still, I see it circling back around, is that people are still blaming point straps on dressage saddles for muscle atrophy, or that they're the root of all evil. And when I first started, that was a trend, that the point straps, so that billet that comes down from the very front of a dressage saddle, you don't typically see it on jumping saddles, are, you know, the problem. And any saddle with one needs to be removed, and the billets need to be, you know, centrally located. Well, now I look back on that, and, you know, that's what you were being taught and told. And a lot of the information was coming from the veterinary world, where they were seeing saddles cause damage to scapulas and made the leap to that it was the billeting system that was causing that.
Okay.
And then it became the truth. It just became gospel. That's the problem, is these billeting systems. And, you know, I was just a service provider. I wasn't actually confident enough to say, I appreciate that they have many years of med school and, you know, a thriving practice, but they should stick to what they know about, because we now know that the billing systems, you know, very much have everything to do with the horse's anatomy. The horse's anatomy dictates what billeting system is going on that saddle. Not, you can't just make a blanket statement and say, you can't have that billeting system on any horse, because some horses will thrive with it, and others, obviously, it's the wrong system and they will suffer. But it will present as a symptom that, oh, I want to take this knowledge and apply it to everything.
Right.
And, you know, it's that, if you stick around long enough, this is kind of my message to these people at it's the 18 month mark with saddle fitters. You know, everyone complains that there's so much turnover in the saddle fitting industry. And it's that 18 month to 2 year mark where they're just so demoralized at what they've been taught isn't working for every single scenario.
Wow.
And they feel like, I was told if you did this, then that would happen. And it's like, yeah, you know, 2 out of 10 times.
Right.
Nothing works all the time. And you have to stick around long enough to go, yeah, this is my workaround. It wasn't just the billeting system. It was that billeting system with that shape of girth on that brand of saddle, on that breed of horse, or that anatomy of horse.
Yeah.
You know, that's that cocktail that doesn't
work. So, this is fascinating. I'm not
sure we're heading with this, but
no,
you know, it is
fascinating. And I find everything that you've just said, I would high five it and amen it and all of that stuff along the way. So let me ask this next question, because I think it kind of goes along with it a little bit. So from your perspective, what are the most crucial parts that each element of the industry needs to be on the same page for? Trends come and go, but what are the basic fundamentals you think everyone should agree upon?
Simply, horse soundness. I have seen everything from, you know, first thing that you're told when you're training to be a saddle fitter is that here's all the things a poor saddle fit can cause, and here's all the classic signs of a poor fitting saddle. And you're never told that it also could be, you know, a soundness issue just in general. You're never told that, oh, it can be just a shoeing problem, or that it's poor training, or that it's conformation. So you have fitters taking on way more responsibility than they ought to be. That I was guilty of that And that's how you have these saddle fitters doing, this is, I might as well be controversial. Any saddle fitter that's commonly practicing asymmetric fits is in an area that maybe they ought not to be. There are some times where doing something asymmetrical with a saddle is warranted, but it's like a hundredth of the time, like it's 1% of the time, not all the time. And it's when you see that that little trick works occasionally, you tend to overuse it. And you see, like, why are you fitting a crooked horse? Why, like, at what point in your mind did you decide that it was in the best interest of that horse and that rider, and it's, and safety as well, not just like that ethically or whatever, but at some point you've overstepped when what you should have said was, this actually isn't a saddle fitting issue. It's pretty clear that, yes, we understand saddles have to fit, and yes, you do have a difficult to fit horse, but your horse is difficult to fit because it's kind of a train wreck. And we, you know, the beauty of it now is, I think that the industry is well serviced, and there's a lot of experienced people like yourself around that. I always say, like, let's not do anything today. You're going to pay me for my time. We're going to put in our back pocket what we've learned, but now you're going to go and get a consult if you're not already working with a body worker. And I tell people all the time, if you're working with a body worker and I'm not comfortable proceeding, I recommend to people all the time, and this from your point of view, you may or may not agree with me, but I'm like, as a lay person, I'm palpating your horse and finding soundness or pain points, trigger points, I'm like, you need a second opinion. Like, do your horse a favor. You wouldn't let your child suffer, or your, if your dog pain management wasn't working well, you'd be at another vet's right away inquiring, like, why? And I encourage people to do that. Just say, look, I'm not satisfied proceeding. And that's a big thing for where you're getting away from the basics. And I think across all, you know, farriers can be guilty of it too, where they're like, this has to be an exotic shoe job. Like, let's set the horse up this way, trying to compensate for something that should have been somebody else's job. That should have been the body worker's job. That should have been the chiro. That should have been the vet. That should have been the trigger point myotherapist. That should have been, we know that dental work is important. We can tell we're in a workshop now, like, compressor is firing up. But you do. Let me close the door. Okay, sorry about that.
No problem.
Yeah, so I see it if everyone's obeying the fundamentals, then everyone can keep it simple.
Yeah.
But I think when you're doing corrective shoeing, corrective saddle fitting, and getting exotic with all of your treatment plans, you see it. There are some clients that they live for that. It's going to happen.
There, I have some
But
clients.
I
Well,
just
I wouldn't say that I
towards.
have some clients. I guess I have some clients where there's that expected, like, oh my goodness, there's something wrong with my horse. And now this is wrong. Now that is wrong. And they're doing this, they're doing that. And I'll walk in for the appointment and they're showing me with their so skilled palpation skills how sore their horse's back is. And I'm like, wait a minute, let's just take a moment and promise me one thing. I ask them, or I say to them, and they'll go, what? And I said, do not palpate your horse's back one time before I come back for the next appointment. Just leave it alone. Do your thing. Like, just groom it, all of this kind of stuff. Stop looking for stuff. And I agree with what you said too about the whole finding a second opinion. I firmly believe in that. And just like you, I think there's an education, there's an experiential aspect to people who are out there providing a service. And I totally agree that in the beginning for myself, when you're out there and you're trying to build a business and you develop those relationships, that it can be easy to try to go over the top to provide a service of goodwill and developing a good relationship with these people. And there comes a time where it's like, okay, you just trust your gut. And like you said, it's very instinctual. And yeah, you just kind of, there's a flow that I think a lot of the times what I see out there now is not happening. It's very, I don't know. It's very quick to change direction, which then does not allow the horse and rider and everybody else in the team to find their way back on the path. Everything just happens too quickly. There's no patience.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Yeah, and I you know, and I say to clients, because when they're trying to find a solution, and I've had some good conversations with body workers, and I use that as a general terms because there's so many, sometimes what I say to people, like I used to just introduce everyone as like, oh, you're a massage therapist. And they're like, I'm not a massage therapist. I am a, and then it's something that I'd never heard of. And I'm like, so essentially you manipulate muscles though, right? And so, but it's so it's just body work. Fine. But the idea that you can, it would be like us going to the gym and never experiencing muscle soreness one time. The idea that you can train a horse, ask it to progress in its training, moving from up into high school movements. And we see that with clients all the time when they're like that. There's a sweet spot where a horse is, basically everyone's agreed or that it's not going past second level, or it's never jumping, like it's just going to be doing very simple tasks, and it stays in that sweet spot where it's always comfortable in its body, it's never being overworked or things like that. But then, with dressage horses in particular, where it's like we're moving up a level this year, and then you see like he's sore, he's this, he's that, and it's like, yeah, like you would be too, so there's not every time where there's smoke, it's not a dumpster fire. It's just, hey, that's what happens with soft tissue when we are building muscle. And that's where your circle of people around you, it should be people that you trust, your fitter, that you trust everyone in your circle to be giving you good information and saying, yeah, this is something a day off would fix, or like we don't have to immediately start saddle shopping or
Yeah.
change up all our service providers because it's no longer working. But
Yeah. What you described there, what you described
it's
there, I often
horses are,
describe to to the owners of the horses I work on is it's a hazard of the job. Like you said, going to the gym, you're going to have some muscle soreness, et cetera. But when you're working your horse up through the levels, it's a hazard of the job that they're going to start having muscles that might be feeling a little ouchy. It doesn't mean the world's falling.
yeah, and we would expect to see it.
Yeah.
And that's the beauty of having some consistency. The saddle fitting tends to still be a reactive thing. People are, oh, something's going on, call the fitter out, instead of the confidence that comes from, no, I get regular fittings. Unless something broke or something atypical has happened, I'm pretty confident, like maybe we'll bump our next appointment up from 8 months to 6 months or something. But, you know, if you're always being reactive with your program, you will never be satisfied. You're it's just asking everyone, you know, instead of getting, you know, your clients that are using you regularly as maintenance, rather than, okay, something's going on. You know, and I always say to people, like, they'll start raising concerns over their saddle or saddle fit, and I'm like, look, some of them I know are on a maintenance program with their massage therapist. I'm like, they will know before you or I do. They typically, like, and saddles do need regular maintenance. They do eventually, either through horse development, but most of the time, a lot of people think, oh, my horse has changed so much, the saddle doesn't fit anymore. And I'm like, no, your saddle's just compressed. I would love to say that you did all this amazing work and your horse is drastically different, but the reality is that, especially wool flocked panels, that flocking is compressing from the day after I did the work. So you're seeing a degradation in your fit by micro amounts, but that fit is degrading from the time I do it. And it's kind of like the brake pads on your car. Like, you're using your brakes. Don't be shocked when your mechanic says you need new brakes, and you're like, but the last time I was here, you said I didn't need them. It's like, no, well, because you've been using them. So, you know, and if you're using your saddle, you will be deteriorating that fit. It's not always a change in the horse. And I think that's a message that keeps getting put out all the time, is that these horses are changing dramatically. And they do, and they can, and I'm not saying they don't, but I'm just saying the majority of the times, it's just, yeah, your flocking has compressed. It's time for a top up. And we put the reset button, and now we're back to that. But when you have a good program, and when your fitter says, you know what, or your massage therapist or body worker says, yeah, I would call Christian, because this is what I'm feeling, tends to typically be a saddle fit issue. So, you know, it's nice when you have a good circle of people around you that you trust, that are consistent.
Absolutely.
Then we're all working together,
Yeah.
you know. And
Yeah.
sometimes it's me saying, oh, I don't know what your last massage was, but I'd step up the program. Or, you know, again, like, I've seen this horse 10 times, you know, it's not, I'm the worst note taker in the world, but my client base, I've always kept small. I've never been interested in global domination. I just work a pretty consistently small area regularly. So you're seeing, you know, clients more often, and you know, you're like, yeah, something's different.
Okay,
You
so
know,
along
whether
that line
something's
then,
changed, sometimes it's a change in,
along that line, describe a typical week for you at work. What goes into being a successful fitter, and what would surprise people about what you do?
Yeah, so my role is very different now. So I took a break from fitting up until recently, and now I'm back out on the road, but only part time. And it was kind of the pull of missing the job. But a typical week, like, I for a few years for well for many years I was kind of always lusting after more bench work. So work, like, and it's partly because when you do major repairs, it's really rewarding and fun, but it's stuff that it can't be done on the tailgate of a pickup truck in your the yard of your stable, right? You know, you need you know, equipment, you need a shop environment, and, you know, so you're putting the new seat in the saddle, or retreeing a saddle, or, you know, major rebuild work like that. So that's what my typical week looks like now. But the saddle fitting side of it, every fitter, it's pretty standard. You know, you're there's tons and tons and tons of driving, and your whole
Yes.
goal is to try and have, you know, multiple clients on the same farm, so that you're not having to get in your car every single time you have to see a new appointment. But yeah, that's what a typical week is, more bench work and just really kind of at the moment 1 week a month on the road. When I took that time off from fitting, obviously, you know, clients have found new fitters to work with, which is kind of exciting because the health of the industry means that, you know, hey, there are other fitters to go to, which is exciting because I still feel that the fitting industry is a little bit underserviced,
Yeah.
just because there is it is high turnover because I think people get burnt out and disillusioned, and it's that 18-month to 24-month mark where that kind of hits, and you know, but I don't know if there'd be anything surprising about what I do in a week, but not for me anymore. I don't know. I think anybody, clients are still fascinated. I mean, they could have ridden for 25 years and they watch you work on a saddle and they are absolutely fascinated. It never gets old. And it's like, you know, I think, you know, you hear it over and over again that clients are like, oh, I didn't know that that would work that way, or I didn't. You know, in the latter years, I've started doing more and more in front of clients. And that's partly as your confidence grows that you're like, yeah, I'm not trying to hide anything. Let's do this work together. Because I really like it when people are like, you saw me do the work. Like
Yes.
your understanding of what just happened is gone beyond, oh, I took it outside, did
Right.
something, and came back in. Because sometimes people are like, oh, I thought it would take longer, or you know, they just have no concept of what you did because you left them out of the loop. So I started, you know, setting up a table in the aisle of the barn and going, yeah, we're going to do this here now together. And you know, some clients that have known you for a long time, they're like, okay, I've seen this many times, so I'm going to get coffee. You know, but which is fine too, but it's the ones that are truly interested in what you do and how you do it. So it's a mini clinic. You're educating the rider at the same time. So, but yeah, I'm not sure
Just love your
how much
philosophy.
surprise.
I love the things that you've shared. I just you the Keep It Simple Saddler I think is amazing. I love the fact that you're
Yeah.
about educating, that your experience comes through, that you're very authentic about what you do. And I too, like I said, I love your philosophy about it. I totally agree. It shouldn't be complicated. Everything should just be simple and informative. And I am so grateful that we've had this conversation. And I have one more question for you. If you had to do it over again, would you change anything about your career or the choices you've made?
Yeah, 100%. Of course, hindsight, of course, but it's not until you get older. I a few years ago had a real horrible experience, and as I was analyzing that experience in business, so without going into great detail, you know, basically had ended up in a scenario that was completely wrong for me. Kind of fun fact out of that is what emerged from that is like I am happier, healthier, financially better off. They're just only good things happened out of kind of a deepest, darkest moment. But what led me there? What and how I ended up in a place I didn't want to be, surrounded by people that I shouldn't have been around, was a lack of understanding myself. I lost my way a little bit. And, you know, I encourage anybody in life, in business, is I think everyone feels that they're being mentored by somebody. And what I realize now is that when I look back at everyone who I thought was a mentor was actually a boss who would have said whatever it took to get me to work on my day off or to sell more, or, you know, they're not mentoring you. They're getting the most out of you. Are they getting the best out of you? I don't know. So what I'm saying is that what helped me was a life coach. And if I had anything to do over again, I just think, you know, I don't know when the time is right. I have two young teen children, and I'm actually thinking about trying to integrate life coaching into their life. Like, I don't think there's any point that it's too early to start working with a life coach. And if people are not understanding exactly what a life coach does, educate yourself. They're just a phenomenal resource. And getting you to help you understand yourself better. And because everyone's recipe for success and definition of success and the goals people are chasing, sometimes were set at 20. Well, at 35, you're a different person with different needs and things, or maybe, you know. And for me, I think I just didn't get it. I was lost. And then here comes someone that you're at. Yes, you're paying them, but they don't, they're not, they're only interested in facts. They're not interested in, they have no personal connection to you, in a sense that it's like, hey, I just got to say whatever. I think this guy's going to quit and I don't want to have to hire somebody. Or, you know, a life coach is just someone who they're not bringing any biases to the relationship. You know, in my opinion, they're just bringing some data, some tools that we're probably all missing. And, you know, if I had have had those tools earlier on, I would have, my mistakes would have been less expensive. And probably the cycle, the recovery time from those mistakes would have been dramatically shorter. So, yeah, I mean, I have a wealth of knowledge now, very expensive mistakes, but as I say, out of it comes a happier, healthier person. Fantastic. But I just wish that had been a more common, mm-hmm. Acceptable practice. I mean, I think this is a life coach is a term in modern language. Not, I think I'm old fashioned in a sense that you think your parents might be your life coach, or your older brother, or, you know, your boss, or, you know, everyone has, like, I remember my first manager, he was awesome, or she was fantastic. And I mean, I don't think I ever really had the benefits of those. And as I say, those people are the ones who they have biases. They think they know you, or they think they know what's best for you, or they know what's best for them. And what's best for them is maybe if you just shut up and got back to work. So whatever they can say to get you to just get back to work. Yeah. But I think probably with a massage therapist life and a saddle fitter's life, you spend your day. And it doesn't matter if you're introverted, extroverted, it doesn't matter. You spend if it's basically to work an 8-hour day, you got to work a 14-hour day. Like to see clients, to see a reasonable amount of clients where you're profitable, you're doing 3, 4, 5 hours of driving a day. And that's time that you're in the car by yourself, alone with your thoughts, thinking, overthinking. You know, sometimes it's fantastic. Sometimes you're like, I finally had enough time to walk around this problem horse that I was experiencing an issue with, and a lot of times it's working with horses, it's your issues are with the owners. Like it's a people problem. Like how do I solve this communication issue with the owner? Things are going well with the horse, but it's their view of it. But the reality is, like, all that time, these long days, and then the time that you are around people, it is you're performing. You're on your best behavior. You're communicating. You're educating. You're doing your job. You're being professional. So it's very tough to find that time where it's just like, you know, I've seen it before where fitters or massage therapists show up and they start complaining about their life to customers. And you're like, yeah, you can't do that. That's you should be talking to your life coach about those
Coach.
things. Yeah. So anyway,
Yes,
life coach,
no,
that's what it is. It
I have to
is
say
a game changer.
it's great to hear you say that. I totally appreciate that. I too have a life coach. That's how I got into life coaching. And yeah, life coach takes you from where you are to where you want to be. And like you said, they're unbiased. They deal with the facts. It's as a life coach, I find it extremely satisfying. It's a lot of fun. I just love helping. And like you said, someone might think, oh yeah, this is my goal. This is what I want to do. But from an outsider's point of view, they might say, well, how about this? Because things are different, or have you considered that? Or, you know, that kind of thing. So it really is a process to peel back the layers. And I really appreciate you. And again, the wisdom that you've shared, your insight. I swear we're living parallel lives as far as what we do on a day-to-day and how we've come along. It's been really interesting. I'm so glad that we've reconnected, and I would love to stay connected with you. If people want to get in touch with you for your saddle expertise, how can they do that?
You know, the easiest way through social media, this works for me. You know, hunt me down on social media. Or I don't know, we can put it up my email. I can give you my email, that type of thing. But yeah, it's the easiest that way. Yeah, I don't get into a lot of fancy ways of getting in touch with me. Just
Gotcha.
Google.
All right, Christian. Well, thank you so much, and we will be in touch.
Awesome. Well, I thank you for doing this. This is great. I'm glad these conversations are taking place, and you're just doing a fantastic job with great questions and, you know, a lot of insight there. It's nice.
So there you have it. I have some great interviews lined up for future episodes, and we'll be covering some pretty interesting topics, as always, with the intent to open and engage the horse world on a wide variety of issues. So until next time, keep your eyes forward and continue to hit your stride. To stay current with Hitting Your Stride, subscribe on my website or wherever you download your favorite podcasts. If you like what you've heard here today, make sure you share and leave a comment to help guide future episodes and widen the audience. And be sure to check out social media to keep up to date with Equestrian Elements Life Coaching.